8-bit system. He expected at least 40 new 8-bit games in the second half of 1991, though obviously the company's focus would shift to the more advanced Super Nintendo. Based on the perpetual sold-out situation in Japan, Nintendo had nothing but the highest of expectations. They estimated selling 2 million units by the end of the year, and already anticipated shortages during the Christmas season. Blah, 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 Olufsen thought. Hand out a memo, smile for the camera, and let's move on to more important matters. Everyone already knows what you're about to say. Sony plus Nintendo equals CD-romance. Compact discs will play a key role in Nintendo's vision for the future, Lincoln finally announced, now ready to reveal the plans for Nintendo's new CD unit. Olufsen stirred in his seat as the crowning moment inched closer. And who better to partner with than the company that invented the audio compact disc, Philips Electronics? Wait, what? A tremor of shock and confusion swept through the room as journalists raced to take note that Lincoln had said Philips and not Sony. After Lincoln said it again, confirming that his words were not a slip-up, all eyes turned to Olaf Olufsen, who tilted his head and furrowed his brow. Was he shocked? Appalled? Furious? In truth, he was none of those things. He was merely plotting his next move. "Did he just say Philips?" Nilsson whispered to Kalinske as both men stood in the back of the room. "As in, not Sony?"
"It would appear that way,"
Kalinske whispered back, speaking a little louder than he intended due to the unexpected smile on his face. Kalinske kept his eyes fixed on Olufsen. He didn't personally know Sony's president of electronic publishing, but he was impressed by the man's reaction, which showed class, tact, and diplomacy. In fact, by the time Lincoln concluded his press conference, Kalinske could have sworn he detected a hint of amusement in Olufsen. He wanted to go over and introduce himself, but realized that it wasn't the right time. Reporters were swarming around Olufsen, looking for an emotionally charged quote, and Kalinske and Nilsson should have returned to Sega's booth 15 minutes ago. What neither of them knew was that only a few weeks earlier, Arakawa and Lincoln had flown to the Philips World headquarters in Eindhoven, Netherlands, for a meeting with Gaston Bastiens, head of the Compact Disc Interactive, CDI, group. The Nintendo executives had traveled there at the behest of Yamauchi, who was growing concerned about an alliance with Sony. He had realized that the deal he signed in 1988 gave Sony the right to control software for a joint CD venture. This detail hadn't appeared to be a problem back then, when Sony was exclusively a consumer electronics company, makers of television, stereos, and music devices like the Walkman and Minidisc player. But with their acquisition of CBS Records and Columbia TriStar Films, and now the creation of an electronic publishing group, they were growing too ambitious for Yamauchi's tastes. Sony was already the supplier of the key audio chip in Nintendo's 16-bit console, and he didn't want to enter any alliance that would grant Sony any additional power. This change of heart led Nintendo to go behind Sony's back and sign a deal with Philips. As per their arrangement, Philips would create a CD-ROM drive that hooked up to the Super Nintendo to play games on CD. Additionally, the CD titles that Nintendo created would be compatible with Philips CDI players. Naturally, Nintendo would control the licensing rights to all CD games, regardless of which system they wound up being used on. Because Japanese contracts tended to be succinct, with a large reliance on good faith, Yamauchi felt that he could break the contract and ditch Sony without penalty. He also decided not to inform Sony of his side deal with Philips, to ensure that Sony's humiliation was made public. Although nearly every journalist was now locked on Olufsen, a reporter from Fortune swam against the current and ambled over to Kalinske and Nilsson in the back of the room. "How about this for a headline?" the reporter asked by way of an introduction. "Sega execs crash Nintendo press conference. Leave cowering in fear." "Well, well, well," Nilsson said. "If it isn't Nintendo's biggest fan." The reporter blushed. "Nonsense. I worship at the altar of journalistic integrity." "Well, what can we help you with?" Kalinske asked. The reporter looked at Nilsson with a glint of gloat in his eyes. The Super Nintendo features 32,768 colors, 256 of which can appear on screen at the same time, 8 highly sophisticated sound channels, and a clock rate of 3.58 megahertz. How does Sega plan to compete with this?
Kalinske raised an eyebrow. Journalistic integrity, hmm?
Hey, the reporter said with a smirk. These are just the facts.
Follow us, Nilsson said.
The reporter reluctantly followed Kalinske and Nilsson under a golden seal of quality and into Sega's booth. Like Nintendo, their color scheme was black on black, but that was all they had in common. Sega's setup, bathed in sunlight, exuded an elegantly zany joie de vivre. There were bright colors blinking everywhere, upbeat music throughout, and a giant blue hedgehog standing by the entrance to greet guests as they entered. Sega did a good job of positioning themselves as the offbeat alternative to Nintendo's autocratic reign, but that alone didn't make their booth spectacular. Any mutt trying to outbark the top dog would have done the same. What Sega did that no other company would have dared to do was acknowledge that it was a dog-eat-dog world. At the heart of their booth was a television displaying highlights from Super Mario World. Directly below it was a television showing off Sonic the Hedgehog. In an industry where Nintendo coated the ground in eggshells and cautioned all to walk slowly, Sega was going head-to-head at full speed. The differences between the two games were self-evident. Sonic ran laps around Mario. The Super Nintendo was still 3 months away from being released, and already it looked extinct. Nintendo may have 32,768 colors, Nilsson said to the now speechless reporter. But I think it's safe to say that Mario literally pales in comparison. After considering several creative ways to meet Kalinske's challenge to prove that Sega had the better game, Nilsson had hired a team of researchers and set up play tests around the country, where boys and girls were brought in to play Super Mario World and Sonic the Hedgehog, and decide which was the better game. Since Sonic had been kept under wraps and the Super Nintendo had not yet been released, none of those involved in the experiment had had any experience with either game, though, of course, most already knew of Mario from previous games. And that's exactly what Nilsson wanted. He specified to the researchers that 90% of the subjects should be NES owners, and at least 75% had to consider one of the Mario titles to be their favorite game. He wanted to stack the deck so that the results of these experiments didn't merely tell him what he wanted to hear, but would prove to Kalinske that, beyond any shadow of a doubt, they had a winner. By the end, 80% chose Sonic.
So what do you think? Kalinske asked.
It's great, the reporter conceded. But, devil's advocate, it's just one game.
So young, so naive, Nilsson said, walking him through the rest of the booth.
Sonic was certainly their best game, but it was only one of many. The various displays showed off other titles that would be released later that year, like Mario Lemieux Hockey, Toe Jam and Earl, and Quackshot starring Donald Duck. Sega's already bountiful library of games appeared even more impressive besides those from Electronic Arts, which had been churning out hit after hit exclusively for Sega. The unusual romance between EA and Sega turned out to be a godsend for both companies. Amazingly, Joe Montana Football had turned out not only to be a mega hit, but was in some weeks even outselling the Madden game it had been derived from.
But don't just take my word for it, Nilsson said, pulling out a brochure called The Nintendo Guide to Choosing a Video Game System. Listen to my very intelligent competitor, who specifically suggests buying the console that has the most games. So I encourage everyone to take Nintendo's advice and buy the Sega Genesis.
Over the next few hours, word began to spread. As Nilsson read passages from Nintendo's brochure with near religious conviction, visitors came from across the trade floor to witness Sega's coronation. They wanted to see the charming blue hedgehog, get a look at the 16-bit system that cost $50 less than the Super NES, and see what else was on the horizon from the company that had stolen at least some of Nintendo's thunder. Like a baseball team whose pitcher was throwing a no-hitter, the Sega employees tried not to talk about what they were witnessing, to keep it all business as usual. They'd waited so long for this to happen, never being sure that it actually would. That many were guilty of a private smile, fist pump, or high five from time to time. It was Kalinske's job to act like this was exactly what he had always expected, but even he couldn't hide the hints of laughter on his face. Feeling good, he walked tall to the reception area at the center of Nintendo's booth, where he asked to speak with Arakawa. Not to gloat, but to show his opponent that he meant no disrespect. Unfortunately, he was deprived of a friendly, all's fair in love and war conversation due to Arakawa's busy schedule. "Is he available sometime later today?" Kalinske asked hopefully. No, he's booked solid," the receptionist said, knowing exactly who he was. "Sorry." Kalinske tried for the next day, the day after, 2 months from now in Seattle. "No, sorry. Mr. Arakawa was a very busy man." Kalinske nodded, realizing who and what he was actually up against. He thanked the receptionist and looked around Nintendo's colossal booth, scanning for Arakawa. He had to be there somewhere, lurking amongst the consumers who had excitedly come out to get their first look at the perhaps not-so-super Super Nintendo. Eventually, Kalinske gave up and walked away. As he moved past Nintendo's already obsolete monument to itself, he had the wonderful revelation that Sega actually, legitimately, inconceivably, stood a fighting chance. "Hide behind those consumers while you can," Kalinske thought, "because sooner or later, I'm gonna steal them all." Chapter 18. The Underdog Days of Summer. "I'd love to sit here and promise you the world," Kalinske said, addressing a conference room full of employees ready for battle. "Because in my opinion, that's what you each deserve for all the hard work you've put in. But the truth is that I can't even promise you that a year from now Sega is still going to be making consoles." Now that Nintendo's 16-bit machine had a release date, August 23, 1991, Sega was preparing to make the most of every minute before then. During this critical period, which they called the 16 weeks of summer, Kalinske, Ryo, and Toyota would authorize a series of unorthodox hirings, promotions, and marketing strategies to blunt the impact of the SNES. "Unfortunately," Kalinske continued, "there's not much I can promise in this room today. But I'll tell you one thing I know for sure. We have this summer to give ourselves a chance at actually competing against Nintendo, and I can't even begin to imagine what this group would be capable of accomplishing with such an opportunity." Kalinske paused, and in one swift look around the room, seemed to make individual eye contact with everyone. It was time for the summer games to begin. Week 1. Radio killed the video game star. Nintendo's Peter Main and Bill White ushered in the warm weather by announcing a 3-month, $25 million marketing blitz to promote the upcoming SNES. Because Sega's advertising budget for the entire year was less than what Nintendo had allocated for a single quarter, Sega's strikes had to be more strategic, and their missiles more heat-seeking. In this case, the heat that Sega sought was the older, wiser, and more wise-assy crowd of teens, college kids, and rebellious adults. As Sega continued to define its image, this demographic was no longer simply an economic necessity, but had become an audience that helped sell a narrative vision for Sega. A technologically superior company whose advanced, offbeat products could be appreciated only by those mature enough to handle its power. Sega aspired to be not just the name on a product, but the secretly whispered password of co-conspirators involved in a revolution. To reach this audience, and to do so with a fraction of Nintendo's budget, Sega kicked off the summer with a pair of ambitious marketing campaigns in June. The first was Graduate to Genesis, which aimed to hammer home the concept of Sega representing the next phase of video game evolution, while also catering to a time of year filled with graduation ceremonies. Though Graduate to Genesis presented another opportunity to define Sega, the real goal was to further cut into Nintendo's hold over third-party software developers. The promo offered a free third-party title, purchased by one of 9 companies including EA and Namco, upon the purchase of a Genesis. By doing this, Sega was able to reward the third parties who had taken a chance on them,
and demonstrate to other game makers that perhaps it was time to consider defecting from Nintendo. With a campaign in place that aimed to chisel away at Nintendo's strength, Kalinske wanted another that exploited their weaknesses. One place where Nintendo had little presence was on the radio, so that's where Sega struck next. Nilsson put together a list of radio stations that best exemplified Sega's desired cool, in-your-face identity. He zeroed in on Los Angeles's 102.7 Kiss FM and partnered with them to do an LA-wide 16 weeks of summer campaign with round-the-clock promos, giveaways, and updates from the Segaverse. In addition, the station would help expand Sega's visibility by setting up playable Genesis displays during the station's on-location events at beaches, concerts, and hotspots around the city. Similarly named and equally invasive assaults were launched in Chicago and New York. In addition to dominating a medium that Nintendo had ignored, there was an unexpected benefit to the radio maneuver. Cheryl Kiraz, the senior account executive at Kiss FM, was so smitten with Sega's products that she reached out to Blockbuster Video about bringing them into the mix. At the time, Blockbuster was in the midst of a lawsuit with Nintendo, who had taken a harsh stance against video game rentals, and so they were eager to help out. Blockbuster would gladly set up in-store displays, tout Sega's latest games, and hold gaming contests all summer long, though they wanted to dub the promotion something that honored 102.7 Kiss FM. Sega was gladly willing to forego the semantics, birthing 102 Days of Summer. Whether it was 16 weeks or 102 days, the summer would undoubtedly be long and stressful. Luckily, around this time, Kalinske felt incredibly rejuvenated. After nearly a year apart, his wife and three daughters were finally moving up to live with him in the Bay Area. Things appeared to be finally coming together. Week 2. Mr. Extremely Dangerous. While Kalinske and his family searched for a dream home in the Bay Area, Sega began aggressively putting together a dream team of new employees. Like the brand they were cultivating and the hedgehog they had helped create, Kalinske, Ryo, and Toyota searched for people with a distinct Sega-ness, sharp, scrappy go-getters who craved long odds and last-second victories. As Kalinske continued to look for ways to embody the tone depicted in that Reebok Extremely Dangerous bungee jump ad, he went straight to the source. Reebok's marketing manager, Steve Race. "We're building a team to go to war against Nintendo," Kalinske said. "We're going to take over the video game market. Will you join us?" Race was a clever, foul-mouthed prankster who used his boisterous personality to hide the fact that he was a brilliant marketing strategist. An impossible challenge? Shit, of course he was in. But Race wasn't yet ready to jump feet first into the pool. And for the time being, he wanted to run Sega's marketing department as a consultant. If that was what it took, then Kalinske was okay with it. "Just one question," Race said. "What the hell is a video game?" Kalinske's eyes went wide. Even he had known more than this going in. "Kidding," Race said with a cheeky smile. Not only did Race know what a video game was, but upon joining Sega, he'd immediately become the company's most senior expert. Back in the early 80s, he had been the vice president of marketing and communications for Atari's international division, selling in territories where, notably, no crash had been caused, before co-founding Worlds of Wonder, the toy company that first nationally distributed the NES. "Don't worry about me," Race explained. "I was selling video games back when you were pimping out plastic dolls." Week 3. The Electronics Expert. Sega was adamantly focused on positioning their products as being more than just a simple toy, unlike Nintendo's. They were consumer electronics and should be marketed and sold as such. To make inroads into that realm of retail, Sega's executives targeted Richard Burns, a VP of sales at Sony who moved and spoke with the quiet but powerful demeanor of an assassin. "We don't just want you, Richard," Kalinske said. "We need you." Burns scratched his forehead, intrigued by the idea of moving from bleak New England to sunny California, but concerned about entering a business that overlapped with the pesky terrain of the toy world. "Why me?" he asked. "What I know about video games can sit on the end of your finger." Kalinske nodded. "Good. You'll be perfect."
Burns agreed to take the leap and run the sales department, thus beginning the mission to position the Genesis, and video games as a whole, as consumer electronics, no different from the stereos, VCRs, or camcorders he'd sold during his days at Sony. Burns had been around long enough to feel confident in his ice-to-Eskimo sales skills, but he quickly discovered that getting retailers to take Sega seriously was only half of the challenge. The bigger problem was that his predecessor had either had terrible organizational skills or was an outright anarchist. A lack of any sort of filing system was merely a nuisance, but not having a formalized sales structure was just plain leaving money on the table. There were limited records of which systems and games retailers had ordered from Sega, and almost no information about what had sold through, what had been marked down, and what had been returned. In an environment where it took about 8 months to develop a game and 2 months to produce and ship it, knowing these kinds of things wasn't just helpful, but mandatory. Week 4. Tiny Billboards. The sheer speed of Sonic the Hedgehog was bound to make it a hit, but that wasn't the only goal here. Not even close. Kalinske wanted Sonic to become an instantly recognizable cultural icon who could define the decade and eventually grow into a multi-billion dollar intellectual property that would continue to pump money into Sega for decades even after he'd left the company. This was why Sega of America had been so protective of Sonic. They didn't want him to join that long list of video game characters whose innovative gameplay had made them celebrities, but whose lack of dimension had caused them to fade away. They had to make sure that Sonic would find a better fate than one-hit wonders like Dig Dug, Frogger, or even Mr. and Mrs. Pac-Man, all of which had aged with the ungraceful gawkiness of a former child star. Grand aspirations were certainly admirable, but without proper execution, they were nothing more than delusions of grandeur. Transforming a 16-bit critter into the next Mickey Mouse, however, presented the same problem as marketing against the Super Nintendo. Money. Without a war chest full of financial resources, Sega relied on the kindness of strangers, or, more specifically, writers from the most popular gaming magazines of the era. Game Pro, Video Games and Computer Entertainment, VG&CE, and Electronic Gaming Monthly, EGM, which had been created to fill the growing appetite for video game previews, reviews, and rumors. Though they differed in subtle ways, Game Pro slanted younger, VG&CE skewed older, and EGM swung for mainstream, the editors at each all had one thing in common, a distaste for Nintendo. To Nintendo's credit, Nintendo Power editor-in-chief Gail Tilden consistently churned out a colorfully brilliant issue each month, but they kept the best content for themselves, and so it was exceptionally difficult for the other magazines to adequately cover the industry when the already close-lipped company who dominated over 90% of the market felt little incentive to share information. Up until now, Kalinske's formula for success had always been to rely on his charm, wit, and facility with public speaking. But he was quickly discovering that none of those talents could compare to the power of harnessing the hatred for his competitor. In the same way that Blockbuster had been eager to rain on Nintendo's parade, Sega hoped that the scorned magazines could help advance their agenda. Kalinske knew that the gaming magazines typically appealed to only the most hardcore fans, but it wasn't just them he wanted to reach. The magazine's greatest asset wasn't the readership, but rather the physical space they occupied. With wide circulations, these magazines populated newsstands, kiosks, and drugstores around the country, which made each cover almost like a tiny billboard. So, maybe John Doe didn't care at all about video games, but when buying his paper each morning, he would inadvertently notice the bright game magazine covers, and a small imprint would be created. It would be only seconds each day, but they would add up. To make the math work, Kalinske relied on Nilsson. Ever since joining Sega in 1989, Nilsson had always made it a priority to build strong relationships with the press. He made it a personal policy to return every call from anyone at any publication, and when doing so, he would always have a memorable quote ready. He was all about going the extra mile, whether that entailed flying out to Los Angeles to have lunch with writers from VG&CE, or trekking out to Lombard, Illinois to meet new members of the EGM team. Nilsson took great pleasure in seducing the tastemakers. But what really made his tactics work was that they were not tactics at all. As he saw it, these people were devoting their lives to writing about what he did for a living. They made his life easier, and he wanted to return the favor. It was less about sneakily seeking competitive advantages, and more about demonstrating good manners. And if his sentiment contrasted with that of Nintendo, then that was just the cherry on top. This all put Nilsson in a great position to ask for assistance when it came time to make Sonic a star. He coordinated a three-pronged attack of magazine covers, hitting EGM in May 1991, and then VG and CE and GamePro 1 month later. In addition, Sega released a 16-page promotional Sonic comic, which not only grabbed more eyeballs on newsstands, but was Trojan-horsed inside other publications, like Disney Adventures and an issue of Superman. As the warm days grew longer, and Sega of Japan neared completion of Sonic the Hedgehog, Kalinske didn't quite know what to expect. But he was feeling optimistic, and pleased that Nilsson had acquired so much tiny but omnipresent real estate. Week 5. Superstars Wanted. In addition to attracting eyeballs, Kalinske also craved hands. More specifically, he wanted to get Sega products into the hands of people who personified verve and coolness. In a perfect world, Sega would have hired young celebrities to star in commercials. In a less perfect world, they would have at least run ads during shows that featured those young celebrities. In reality, however, money was tight, airtime was expensive, and networks weren't in the business of granting discounts to unknown companies. Still, Kalinske knew that if Sega could only afford an ad buy during one primetime show, it was still worth the risk. They'd just better be damn sure they found the right show. ABC's Full House, NBC's Saved by the Bell, CBS's Major Dad. But why pick only one when you can have them all? In the Sega spirit of killing a flock of birds with a single stone, Kalinske and his team developed a crafty solution. Instead of running an ad during a hit show, they would create a hit show of their own. Nilsson spearheaded a deal with producer Richard Rovsek to create a syndicated primetime special, shot at Universal Studios, in which young sitcom stars would compete against one another in a series of zany athletic events for their favorite charities. Sega financed the operation, and between naming the special and including challenges like hedgehog races and Game Gear duels, they benefited from a parade of product placement. It would have been easy to dismiss this as shameless promotion, but with such a bright constellation of trend-setting teenage stars, no one complained. They would all be there, the princes and princesses of the TV universe, hunks and babes, like Saved by the Bell's Mark Paul Gosselaar and Tiffany Amber Thiessen, loving on-screen sisters, Full House's Candace Cameron and Jodie Sweetin, squabbling on-screen brothers, Home Improvement's Jonathan Taylor Thomas and Zachary Ty Bryan, and even a few second fiddles from Blossom, Growing Pains, and Who's the Boss, each hoping to seize the spotlight. All of them had eagerly signed up to star in the Sega Star Kid Challenge, breaking free of laugh tracks and very special episodes to compete in raft races, obstacle courses, and tug-of-wars set above a pool of whipped cream. Though the show would not air until June, filming had taken place on April 18th and 19th at Universal Studios Hollywood. Kalinske and Nilsson had flown down to oversee the proceedings, along with an excited Toyota, who brought his daughter to marvel at Sega's intersection with glitz and glamour. As they had hoped, it turned out to be a wonderfully raucous event, tied together by host Scott Baio and his Happy Days. Filming had gone off without a hitch, and now, 2 months later, they tuned in to see the fruits of their labor. The high ratings, coupled with the costumed Sonic the Hedgehog persistently lurking in the background of most scenes, indicated to Sega of America that things were looking rather peachy. The only foreseeable pit was running out of money. Even on a shoestring budget, their plans to launch Sonic, and in effect relaunch Genesis, the Sega name, and their own careers, were adding up very quickly to some serious cash. Still, Kalinske knew that now was not the time to back down. What's another $100,000 today, he thought, to build a $100 million property tomorrow? Nakayama, however, didn't see things as clearly when Kalinske called seeking additional funds.
"We have budgets for a reason," Nakayama reminded him.
"Correct?" "Believe me, I know that you don't love getting calls like these, Kalinske said. But it's my job to evaluate opportunities and then ask.
As with Walmart?
Nakayama asked with a tiny groan. Kalinske was rendered momentarily speechless, as things had still not progressed on that front as well as he hoped. While Sega had been running the Genesis store in Bentonville and taken over the city's billboards, for the time being, Walmart continued to stonewall Sega, though Kalinske was convinced they were about to crack. Hey, Kalinske said, it takes money to
make money.
Yes. I was going to say that it takes money to take people's money, but I admit my wording was primarily a function of attempting to spice things up. Nakayama chuckled, though his skepticism was still evident. Neither man said anything for a while. Finally, Nakayama broke the silence.
Okay, Tom. Keep doing what you are doing. Sega of Japan will help out.
Nakayama hung up, though Kalinske could still hear Nakayama's groan ringing in his head. Week 6. Altering the Beast. Make a fucking decision already! Steve Race shouted, and then slammed down the phone. Race's words were loud enough to draw Kalinske to his office, but rational enough not to cause him concern. What's wrong? Kalinske asked.
I don't know, Race said,
trying to shrink complex frustrations into a string of intelligible words.
Just having my patience tested by our friends in Japan. First, they won't show me game footage, then they won't even share a synopsis. Then all of a sudden they might send me some screenshots, but a synopsis is still off the table. How the hell do they expect me to sell a mystery box with a goddamn question mark inside?
Don't worry about that nonsense right now, Kalinske suggested. There's a whole other beast I could use your help with. With the marketing plans coming together, Sega was now faced with the logistical conundrum of getting Sonic from production lines in Japan into living rooms in America. Because the game would be bundled with the Genesis, this wasn't simply a matter of sorting, shipping, and selling. The situation was made more complicated by the fact that at this very moment, Sega's warehouses were overflowing with about 150,000 unsold Genesis systems containing Altered Beast, with about 100,000 more collecting dust on shelves at retailers all across the United States. Financially, Sega couldn't afford to just write off a quarter of a million systems, but commercially, they couldn't in good conscience sell soon-to-be-obsolete systems to customers who would feel foolish or deceived that they didn't get Sonic. Sega could have waited until the rest of the Altered Beast systems sold out, but they weren't selling all that fast to begin with. Besides, the whole point of unleashing Sonic now was to cuckold the Super Nintendo. The whole situation had a vaguely solve for X middle school algebra feel to it, and ideas were tossed around for days. Finally, they found a way to kill two birds with one stone and set a schedule to make it happen. June 15th. Lower price of Genesis plus Altered Beast to $149.95. June 30th. Third-party Graduate to Genesis promotion ends. July 1st. Begin promotion entitling customers to receive a free Sonic game by mail. Mid-July. Begin shipping Genesis units plus Sonic the Hedgehog to retailers. Mid-July to mid-August. Ship remaining Genesis units plus Altered Beast to select retailers. September 15th. Exclusively sell Genesis plus Sonic the Hedgehog at $149.95. This final strategy would offer the best of all worlds. Customers would be happy to get two games for the price of one, and retailers would be happy to unload the old hardware systems. Meanwhile, while the retailers were busy unloading the 100,000 units of old inventory, SOA and SOJ were busy with their own 150,000 units, though the product didn't physically travel far. The employees on both continents would open boxes of the old systems, remove the console, and then repackage it into a brand new box containing Sonic on the cover and the new game inside. Week 7. Sonic Boom. Unlike movies, books, and music albums, in 1991, there was no official release date for video games. When a game hit stores was a matter of logistics, not premeditation. There were just too many variables and too many unaffiliated retailers. Besides,
Mostly, the product came in from Japan in dribs and drabs. As a result, there was no game-changing D-Day for Sonic the Hedgehog, but rather a period of several weeks in late June and early July when the blue blur started showing up in stores. Nevertheless, as soon as Sonic sped into the homes and hearts of a few players around the country, word spread exponentially, in schoolyards, on college campuses, and around water coolers. And because Kalinske had been granted approval from Japan to pack Sonic with the system, it wasn't just $50 games that were flying off the shelves, but Genesis consoles that cost three times that much. And when people bought a Genesis, not only would they end up buying more games later, but most important, they likely would not purchase a Super Nintendo. A line had been drawn in the sand, and the only way to hang out with Sonic was by stepping onto Sega's side. As sales of the Genesis doubled, tripled, and then quadrupled, Kalinske couldn't help but stare at the figures in his office and secretly want to see the faces of Sega's board of directors in Japan. He knew how stupid they thought he was to give it away for free. He remembered how condescending their smiles had been when they shouted at him in Japan. What were they feeling at this very moment, Kalinske wondered. And what would they be feeling a month from now when Sega of America's success continued to grow? Kalinske allowed himself just a moment to gloat. Then Kalinske reminded himself that Sega was one company, and together SOJ and SOA were inciting a pop cultural revolution. And yet, even as he had this thought, a small part of him couldn't help but root for Sega of America to beat the living daylights out of Sega of Japan and make those directors choke in their condescending smiles. It was only a small part of him, but it was a part of him nonetheless. Week 8. The happiest place on Earth. Financial reports, sales figures, and market breakdowns can capably tell a story, but the power of numbers will never compare to that of anecdotal evidence. And in the weeks following Sonic's release, everyone at Sega had their own story. A friend called to say that his son kept curling up in a ball and trying to zoom around the house. Some kids at the mall were tapping their shoes like Sonic. The guys at the comic store were arguing about who would win a race between Sonic and the Flash. The realization amongst Sega's employees that what they did in this small office made real-life ripples filled their lives with an anything-as-possible excitement that most of them had lost at some point during their childhood. Kalinske collected similarly inspiring anecdotes of his own, though his favorites were the second-hand stories that his daughters shared about their Sonic-loving friends at summer camp. To celebrate Sonic Mania, he took his family to Disneyland. Kalinske and Karen locked arms and led the way, the giddy girls scampering along by their side. Together, they strolled through the crisscrossing little streets of Kalinske's favorite section of the park, Fantasyland. In addition to the teacups, it had the Matterhorn, Mr. Toad's Wild Ride, and It's a Small World. He knew that it was en vogue to mock It's a Small World, to call those animatronic dolls creepy or brush off the music as maniacal. But he loved how it was one of the few rides that actually tried to impart a message. Peace, love, unity, community. It strived for more, and maybe it failed, but there was something respectable about how it tried. Kalinske was humming the ride's hypnotic music when Karen gently nudged him. "Look," she said. Kalinske assumed that it must be another Sonic the Hedgehog devotee doing something hedgehoggy, but it wasn't. He followed the path of his wife's gaze to a father and daughter moving in the opposite direction. The father was sweaty and tired, but trying his best to remain enthusiastic as he pushed a pale little girl in a wheelchair. It was Bruce Caspar and his daughter, Anique, Kalinske's former neighbors from Los Angeles. Karen flagged them down, and they all talked and laughed and remembered when. A couple of times Tom and Karen kindly tried to probe about what was wrong with Anique, but Bruce brushed off the question and explained that she was just sick. Following this encounter, the Kalinskes would learn that Anique had pediatric AIDS, but even before they were aware of the diagnosis, they could tell that the situation was bad. Despite the gravity of her illness, however, Anique wore the biggest smile of them all. Happy and upbeat, she shone with a joy so real that it was contagious.
The two families spoke for a while, vowed to keep in better contact, and then went their separate ways, each enjoying a day in the happiest place on Earth. Week 9. Humans against Genesis. Play it again, Kalinske instructed during a meeting between Sega's marketing team and account executives from Bozell, the advertising agency that Michael Katz had worked with to create Sega's previous Nintendon't campaign. The executives were presenting the First National Sonic the Hedgehog commercial. In the spot, a fashionably bespectacled woman dressed like a librarian sits at a desk and speaks to the camera in a saintly, nun-like tone of voice. As the president of a fictitious organization called HAG, Humans Against Genesis, she denounces Sonic for his blazing speed and smarty-pants attitude, and ends by asking, why can't he be more like that nice boy Mario? After running the ad for a second time, the executive stopped the tape. So? He asked expectantly. As all eyes redirected toward Kalinske, he remained silent for a moment. So? Kalinske finally said emotionlessly, matching the executive's cadence. That about sums it up. So what? So this woman is telling us to ignore Sonic and we're supposed to care? What's the point of this? Kalinske looked around. I mean it. What's the point of this commercial? What's the message? What do we want people to feel when they watch this? The room was stunned into silence. They had never seen Kalinske like this before, at least not in the office. He continued on, questioning the reason for the commercial's existence, not in a particularly cruel way, but not in a particularly kind way either. It's supposed to be funny, an executive finally said in defense. Yes, Kalinske said. It's supposed to be funny. But this is just derivative. It's an obvious rip-off of Saturday Night Live's Church Lady, but at least she's less likable. She's prissy without any glimpse of warmth. She's angry on the outside, not the inside, and that makes the hag joke fall flat. Kalinske's spot on, Race interjected. If we're serious about going to war with Nintendo, then it's time for us to start launching grenades. There you go, Kalinske said, nodding to Race. Someone who gets it. But you approved the hag concept, the executive retorted. Yes, Kalinske said with a slap in his voice. And I'd approve it again and again. It's a clever idea if done right. It's supposed to make Genesis owners feel proud to be outsiders, but this is just confusing. It doesn't work. Kalinske shook his head. He had a lot more to say, but saw no point in saying it. It was too late. This was the spot they had produced. I don't like it, he said, and left the room. Kalinske and Race went to his office and began scribbling ideas on a pad. None great, but some decent. Better than the Church Lady ripoff, at least. He kept filling up the page until he felt certain of the answer. He didn't yet know the what, but he knew the how, and he needed to speak with Shinobu Toyota. Hang tight, Kalinske said to Race. I need to speak with our friend Shinobu. Be careful what you say around him, Race cautioned. Kalinske paused before opening the door. Why's that? Oh, come on, Race said as if it were obvious. The guy's a banana. Yellow on the outside, white on the inside. Who knows where his allegiance truly lies? Kalinske rolled his eyes, left the room, and made his way to Toyota's office. He knew that some at Sega still questioned Toyota's devotions, but there wasn't a doubt in Kalinske's mind which side he was on. That's why he was completely unafraid to approach Toyota with what he was about to ask. I need your help.
Of course, Toyota said, waving him in. Tell me what is required.
That ad is all wrong. I know it's tongue-in-cheek, but we're going after ourselves when we ought to be going after Nintendo. Steve is right, we need to go negative, and I need you to get Japan on board. Toyota gave a non-committal nod.
There is a chance this can be done, he said. But hard because they did not even like us to say Sega does what Nintendon't.
Good, Kalinske said. Because that'll be complimentary compared to what we need to do. I'm talking head-to-head, in-their-face, no-turning-back stuff. Like what we did at CES, but on a national scale. Toyota adjusted his shirt cuff as he thought this over.
I know how we can do this, Toyota said at last with a proud smile. But we can only get away with something like this once.
Week 10. Attention, Nintendo console owners. Toyota's strategy for slipping a new commercial past the Japanese gatekeepers was quite simple. He wouldn't tell them until it was too late. He and Ryo would move money around to pay for the new ad, which could be done with relative ease due to the skyrocketing sales of the Genesis. Meanwhile, Sega's marketing team would work with Bozell to create the new ad, which would be ready in time for the release of the Super Nintendo. 3 days prior to the start of the campaign, Toyota would inform Japan about the spot. He would act as if he had been caught off guard and would offer to do everything in his power to pull the ad. In reality, however, it would be too late to stop the process, and the commercial would air at least for a few days. If SOJ was angry, at least SOA would get a few days out of the ad. And if SOJ was okay with the ad, so much the better. Either way, the commercial would air. Kalinske was in his office working with Nilsson on a concept to deliver an uppercut to Nintendo on national television. Or, rather, that's what they were supposed to be doing. Instead, they'd gotten sidetracked as Nilsson paged through a newspaper in search of an article that might be worth reading aloud in his best radio announcer voice. For most of July, newspaper fishing had become a favorite pastime as a string of small but unfavorable developments at Nintendo translated into lucky breaks over at Sega. It had started on July 5th, when a federal judge ruled in favor of Galoob Toys, makers of the Game Genie, in a copyright infringement that would likely cost Nintendo of America $15 million. Then, on July 19th, Mike Tyson, the face of Nintendo's popular boxing game, was arrested and charged with the rape of Miss Black America contestant Desiree Washington. 2 days later, on July 21st, for the first time in 3 years, a Nintendo product was not the number one selling toy in the country. They had been displaced by a gigantic water gun called the Super Soaker. Kalinske made it a point to use every piece of good news, no matter how small, to motivate the troops. He would also clip these articles and send them to Walmart each week, along with a barrage of sales reports to show them how quickly the Genesis was flying up the sales charts. "Anything good in there today?" Kalinske asked.
Let us see, Nilsson said, flipping through the newspaper. Here's something, he said, though didn't seem particularly pleased.
He laid the paper on the desk for Kalinske to see for himself. It was a notice that occupied more than a quarter of the page and began with the headline, "Attention Nintendo Console Owners." And the line below that it read, "Did you buy a Nintendo Entertainment System game console between June 1st, 1988 and December 31st, 1990? If so, you are entitled to a $5 coupon." The notice went on to explain how the attorneys general from all 50 states had brought a price-fixing case against Nintendo, which had been settled when Nintendo agreed to pay back $25 million to their customers in coupons.
"Those brilliant bastards," Kalinske said, more impressed than annoyed.
For years, Nintendo had been fighting federal pressure regarding their business tactics at the retail level. Some called their tactics monopolistic, some believed Nintendo was merely being admirably aggressive, and others believed the government's case was nothing more than a witch hunt, another case of Americans trying to stymie the influence of Japan, an argument partially aided by the fact that the initial charges were brought against Nintendo on December 7, 1989, which also happened to be the anniversary of the 1941 attack on Pearl Harbor. Whether the charges were valid, the government's threat was undoubtedly real. And for years, Nintendo had been operating with the sword of Damocles dangling over its head. Now, however, it seems they had managed to steal away the sword and invert the entire situation into an advantage. Instead of facing stiff, crippling penalties like those inflicted upon AT&T and General Electric in years past, Nintendo's punishment was to offer $5 off to customers who'd have to spend at least $50 to use the coupon. That wasn't even a slap on the wrist. It was more like a government-issued printing press allowing Nintendo to keep minting money.
"You worried?"
Nilsson asked.
"Worried?"
Kalinske said. He believed that the 8-bit NES was nearing the end of its life cycle, so the coupon itself didn't particularly bother him. What nagged him, however, was Nintendo's political savvy.
It was as impressive as it was ominous. Worried? Hardly, Kalinske belted. The stronger they are, the sweeter it'll be when we finally take them down.
My thoughts exactly, Nilsson said, sporting a feisty smile.
And for what it's worth, no amount of bureaucratic mumbo-jumbo can change the fact that when a kid walks into a store and sees a Genesis and a Super Nintendo sitting right next to each other, they'll know exactly what to do. You know what I mean?
Kalinske knew exactly what he meant, but failed to reply because his mind was busy replaying the scenario Nilsson had just mentioned. A kid walks into a store.
Week 11. Spy versus Spy.
A kid walks into a store. No, Kalinske thought, that's not right. We're going after teens and adults. The kids are just a bonus. Okay, so someone walks into a store.
Someone? Really?
That's so vague. Who then? A teen wearing a leather jacket? A jock wearing a sweaty uniform? A curvy college co-ed wearing not that much? Don't want to alienate any segment of the market, so maybe all of them should walk into the store. Nah, too crowded, too rehearsed, too diversity for the sake of television.
Kalinske felt like he had the commercial on the tip of his tongue, but every time he opened his mouth to try to let it out, the idea slid down his throat and hid.
Okay, let's try this again. Someone walks into a store. Wait, what kind of store is this anyway?
A tap on the frame of his already open door dragged Kalinske out of his head. It was Toyota, standing in the doorway with what was meant to be a blank expression. Over the past year, however, Kalinske had grown familiar with the nuances of Toyota's seemingly empty expressions and had grown adept at filling in the blanks. This one, for example, said, good news. Not great news, but better than bad news, no?
What is it? Kalinske asked with a hint of concern in his voice.
Though Kalinske believed he had decoded Toyota's expressions, he made sure to keep this to himself. Perhaps it was due to his Japanese heritage, or perhaps it was meant to serve as an ode to the furtive nature of an idealized businessman. But Toyota seemed to place a premium on ambiguity, and Kalinske was happy to play along. Is everything okay? Toyota stepped forward and broke into an unambiguous smile.
Nintendo has made the price official. It shall be $199.
Kalinske matched his smile. Just as we had expected.
Just as we had hoped, Toyota said.
Kalinske was unsure if Toyota's words were meant to echo enthusiasm or remove any insinuation of overconfidence, but they managed to accomplish both goals. Kalinske nodded humbly.
You are absolutely correct.
This is great news. Kalinske thought once again of his teenager, jock, or curvy co-ed walking into a store. They would see a Genesis and a Super Nintendo and have to make a choice. The Genesis would be cheaper and faster, and it would feature a much bigger library of games. No, Kalinske thought with a subtle shake of the head. The library didn't matter, at least not at the moment. All that mattered was the single game that came with the console. Hey, did Nintendo announce which game would be bundled with the system?
Toyota lightly shook his head.
Not yet.
Thanks for the update, Kalinske said. Why don't you go fill Paul in? As Toyota moved toward Ryo's office, Kalinske dialed up Nilsson.
Good news, pal. As expected, Nintendo's pricing their machine at $199, though there's been no decision on which game yet.
In his own office, Nilsson nodded as he listened to Kalinske.
A price of $199 was perfect. Perfecto. Dear Nintendo, thank you for digging your own grave.
But as quickly as Nilsson's mind swelled with excitement, it just as quickly filled with a strange flavor of disappointment. The high price point was good news, but it wasn't anything that he had earned. It was Nintendo's decision, pure and simple, and would have been just the same in a Nilsson-less universe. This prompted Nilsson to decide that he would take action. What kind of action he didn't yet know, but he was committed to giving his colleagues something to be more excited about than just the expected. He thanked Kalinske for the intel, hung up the phone, and walked out of his office like a man on a mission. Not knowing where to go,
Nilsson followed his feet as they led the way. Eventually, after wandering through the building in a nebulous quest for the unexpected, he found himself inside the office of Richard Burns.
Al? Burns asked. Do you need something?
Nilsson's mind whirred as he looked around the office, playing a light-speed game of I Spy, Stapler, Family Photo, White Out, which evolved to thoughts of spy versus spy. Like an actor on stage who remembers his line just in time, Nilsson asked Burns if he knew of any retailers who were especially loyal to Nintendo. Guys who you think would pass along to the other side any information you give them.
Burns thought a moment, then said he did.
Nilsson's eyes lit up. Here's what I want you to do. Call them up and tell them that we are desperately worried that they will pack the new Mario game with the Super Nintendo. And then make it sound like you just slipped up and told them something you shouldn't have.
Burns chuckled and agreed to put on his best dramatic performance. A few weeks later, Nintendo announced that Super Mario World would be bundled with the $199 SNES. Nilsson realized it was unlikely that his ruse had been the reason for this, but at least there was a chance it was because of him. A war was coming, and he didn't just want to be on the winning side. He wanted to be the reason for victory. And now that Nilsson knew for sure that everything would come down to Sonic versus Mario, he had another idea. Something big, something memorable, something unexpected. Across the office, Kalinske was having his own why didn't I think of that earlier moment. Years earlier, during his Barbie days, a toy company named Topper began making dolls based on a character named Dawn. Like Barbie, Dawn was pretty and friendly-looking and had many outfits, but unlike Barbie, she sold for less. By 1972, the Dawn dolls started to sell pretty well, until Kalinske intervened. He created a promotion where, for only $2, customers could swap their cheap Dawn dolls for a luxurious Barbie. One year later, Topper went out of business. Now, Kalinske had an idea to do something similar to Nintendo, but he needed Steve Race to help him pull it off. Week 12. The Haves and the Have-Nots. There are only two occasions when it is perfectly acceptable for a grown man to yelp like a little boy. On New Year's Eve and when watching sports. Tom Kalinske and Steve Race took advantage of the latter when a harshly hit line drive drove in two runs and gave the San Francisco Giants a late inning lead. They were not alone in momentarily unleashing their inner children, as everyone in the forgettable bar they'd found after work seemed to hoot, holler, and high-five like they were 10 years old and had just learned how to make s'mores. Ravenous excitement filled the room until a strikeout by the next batter led to a commercial break, and in unison, all the buzzed businessmen snapped back to their real age. "Did you ever play?" Kalinske asked Race as they sat back down at a small table with a pair of nearly empty beer bottles between them.
"Damn straight. I was very nearly going to play center field for the New York Yankees," Race said wistfully. "Except, of course, they had no idea about this."
Kalinske laughed.
"Reminds me of the time I almost dated Kathy Ireland."
"Well put," Race said, and then leaned back in his chair with a smile that seemed to say, "This is what life's all about. Beer, broads, and baseball."
"So, what's on your mind? You're looking rather exhausted these days. Exuberance, but exhausted."
"You think so?" Kalinske asked, trying to shield any hint of vulnerability.
You hide it well, but it's there to see at certain angles."
Kalinske shrugged. Maybe he was more exhausted than he realized. But he had a job to do.
"I have a wife and 3 daughters. I'm fairly certain that my days of not looking exhausted are long gone."
"Fair enough," Race said.
"So if you brought me out tonight to play marriage therapist, I'm okay with that role, but if that's the case, then expect a hefty invoice."
"Ha!" Kalinske said.
"Not quite. But I did want to discuss your role.
I obviously appreciate having you here as a consultant, but I think it's time for you to officially come in-house and take control of marketing. We're on the cusp of doing something extraordinary, and I want you leading the charge." It was Kalinske's job to always believe that Sega was on the cusp, and to make others believe it too. But for the first time, the facts were starting to look like they warranted his confidence.
Ever since Sega of America had dropped the price of the Genesis and put Sonic in the box, units had been flying off the shelves. Sales of the console skyrocketed throughout July. 20,000 sold one week, 25,000 the next, 30,000 the week after that. Sega of America was on pace to sell more consoles